but Grandfather claimed that he functioned perfectly normally no matter how much he drank, except that sometimes it was very hard to wake him, but if you could wake him, he was normal. There wasn't any Grant, nor any Sherman, nor any Stonewall Jackson on either side so far in this war. No. Nor any Jeb Stuart, either. Nor any Sheridan. It was overrun with McClellans, though. The fascists had plenty of McClellans, and we had at least three of them. He had certainly not seen any military geniuses in this war. Not a one. Nor anything resembling one. Kleber, Lukács, and Hans had done a fine job of their share in the defense of Madrid with the international brigades, and then the old bald, spectacled, conceited, stupid as an owl, unintelligent in conversation, brave and as dumb as a bull, propaganda build-up defender of Madrid, Miaja, had been so jealous of the publicity Kleber received that he had forced the Russians to relieve Kleber of his command and send him to Valencia. Kleber was a good soldier, but limited, and he did talk too much for the job he had. Goltz was a good general and a fine soldier, but they always kept him in a subordinate position and never gave him a free hand. This attack was going to be his biggest show so far, and Robert Jordan did not like too much what he had heard about the attack. Then there was Gaul, the Hungarian, who ought to be shot if you could believe half you heard at Gaylord's. Make it if you can believe 10% of what you hear at Gaylord's, Robert Jordan thought. He wished that he had seen the fighting on the plateau between Guadalajara when they beat the Italians. But he had been down in Estremadura then. Hans had told him about it one night in Gaylord's 2 weeks ago, and made him see it all. There was one moment when it was really lost, when the Italians had broken the line near Trijueque, and the 12th Brigade would have been cut off if the Torija-Brujuega road had been cut.
But knowing there were Italians, Hans had said, we attempted to maneuver which would have been unjustifiable against other troops. And it was successful.
Hans had shown it all to him on his maps of the battle. Hans carried them around with him in his map case all the time, and still seemed marveled and happy at the miracle of it. Hans was a fine soldier and a good companion. Listers and Modestos and Campesinos' Spanish troops had all fought well in that battle, Hans had told him, and that was to be credited to their leaders and to the discipline they enforced. But Lister and Campesino and Modesto had been told many of the moves they should make by their Russian military advisers. They were like students flying a machine with dual controls, which the pilot could take over whenever they made a mistake. Well, this year would show how much and how well they learned. After a while there would not be dual controls, and then we would see how well they handled divisions and Army Corps alone. They were communists, and they were disciplinarians. The discipline that they would enforce would make good troops. Lister was murderous in discipline. He was a true fanatic, and he had the complete Spanish lack of respect for life. In a few armies since the Tartars' first invasion of the West were men executed summarily for as little reason as they were under his command. But he knew how to forge a division into a fighting unit. It is one thing to hold positions. It is another to attack positions and take them. And it is something very different to maneuver an army in the field, Robert Jordan thought as he sat there at the table. From what I have seen of him, I wonder how Lister will be at that once the dual controls are gone. But maybe they won't go, he thought. I wonder if they will go, or whether they will strengthen. I wonder what the Russian stand is on the whole business. Gaylord's is the place, he thought. There is much that I need to know now that I can learn only at Gaylord's. At one time he had thought Gaylord's had been bad for him. It was the opposite of the puritanical, religious communism of Velázquez 63, the Madrid palace that had been turned into the International Brigade headquarters in the capital. At Velázquez 63, it was like being a member of a religious order, and Gaylord's was a long way away from the feeling you had at the headquarters of the 5th Regiment before it had been broken up into the brigades of the new army. At either of those places you felt that you were taking part in a crusade. That was the only word for it, although it was a word that had been so worn and abused that it no longer gave its true meaning. You felt, in spite of all bureaucracy and inefficiency and party strife, something that was like the feeling you expected to have and did not have when you made your first communion. It was a feeling of consecration to a duty toward all of the oppressed of the world, which would be as difficult and embarrassing to speak about as religious experience, and yet it was authentic as the feeling you had when you heard Bach, or stood in Chartres Cathedral, or the cathedral at Laon, and saw the light coming through the great windows, or when you saw Mantegna and Greco and Bruegel in the Prado. It gave you a part in something that you would believe in wholly and completely, and in which you felt an absolute brotherhood with the others who were engaged in it. It was something that you had never known before, but that you had experienced now, and you gave such importance to it, and the reasons for it, that your own death seemed of complete unimportance, only a thing to be avoided because it would interfere with the performance of your duty. But the best thing was that there was something you could do about this feeling, and this necessity, too. You could fight. So you fought, he thought. And in the fighting soon there was no purity of feeling for those who survived the fighting and were good at it. Not after the first 6 months. The defense of a position or of a city is a part of war in which you can feel that first sort of feeling. The fighting in the Sierras had been that way. They had fought there with the true comradeship of the revolution. Up there, when there had been the first necessity for the enforcement of discipline, he had approved and understood it. Under the shelling, men had been cowards and had run. He had seen them shot and left to swell beside the road, nobody bothering to do more than strip them of their cartridges and their valuables. Taking their cartridges, their boots, and their leather coats was right. Taking the valuables was only realistic. It only kept the anarchists from getting them. It had seemed just and right and necessary that the men who ran were shot. There was nothing wrong about it. Their running was a selfishness. The fascists had attacked, and we had stopped them, on that slope, in the gray rocks, the scrub pines, and the gorse of the Guadarrama hillsides. We had held along the road under the bombing from the planes, and the shelling when they brought their artillery up, and those who were left at the end of that day had counterattacked and driven them back. Later, when they had tried to come down on the left, sifting down between the rocks and through the trees, we had held out in the sanitarium, firing from the windows and the roof, although they had passed it on both sides, and we lived through knowing what it was to be surrounded until the counterattack had cleared them back behind the road again. In all that, in the fear that dries your mouth and your throat, in the smashed plaster dust, and the sudden panic of a wall falling, collapsing in the flash and roar of a shell burst, clearing the gun, dragging those away who had been serving it, lying face downward and covered with rubble, your head behind the shield working on a stoppage, getting the broken case out, straightening the belt again, you now lying straight behind the shield, the gun searching the roadside again, you did the thing there was to do and knew that you were right. You learned the dry-mouthed, fear-purged, purging ecstasy of battle, and you fought that summer and that fall for all the poor in the world, against all tyranny, for all the things that you believed, and for the new world you had been educated into. You learned that fall, he thought, how to endure, and how to ignore suffering in the long time of cold and wetness, of mud, and of digging and fortifying. And the feeling of the summer and the fall was buried deep under tiredness, sleepiness, and nervousness and discomfort. But it was still there, and all that you went through only served to validate it. It was in those days, he thought, that you had a deep and sound and selfless pride that would have made you a bloody boar at Gaylord's, he thought suddenly. No, you would not have been so good at Gaylord's then, he thought. You were too naive. You were in a sort of state of grace. But Gaylord's might not have been the way it was now at that time either. No, as a matter of fact, it was not that way, he told himself. It was not that way at all. There was not any Gaylord's then. Kharkov had told him about those days. At that time, what Russians there were had lived at the Palace Hotel. Robert Jordan had known none of them then. That was before the first partisan groups had been formed, before he had met Kashkin or any of the others. Kashkin had been in the north at Irun, at San Sebastian, and in the abortive fighting toward Vitoria. He had not arrived in Madrid until January, and while Robert Jordan had fought at Carabanchel and at Usera, in those 3 days when they stopped the right wing of the fascist attack on Madrid and drove the Moors and the Tercio back from house to house to clear that battered suburb on the edge of the gray, sun-baked plateau and establish a line of defense along the heights that would protect that corner of the city, Kharkov had been in Madrid. Karkov was not cynical about those times either when he talked. Those were the days they all shared when everything looked lost, and each man retained now, better than any citation or decoration, the knowledge of just how he would act when everything looked lost. The government had abandoned the city, taking all the motor cars from the Ministry of War in their flight, and old Miaha had to ride down to inspect his defensive positions on a bicycle. Robert Jordan did not believe that one. He could not see Miaha on a bicycle, even in his most patriotic imagination, but Karkov said it was true. But then he had written it for Russian papers, so he probably wanted to believe it was true after writing it. But there was another story that Karkov had not written. He had 3 wounded Russians in the Palace Hotel for whom he was responsible. They were 2 tank drivers and a flyer, who were too bad to be moved, and since at that time it was of the greatest importance that there should be no evidence of any Russian intervention to justify an open intervention by the fascists, it was Karkov's responsibility that these wounded should not fall into the hands of the fascists in case the city should be abandoned. In the event the city should be abandoned, Karkov was to poison them to destroy all evidence of their identity before leaving the Palace Hotel. No one could prove from the bodies of 3 wounded men, one with 3 bullet wounds in his abdomen, one with his jaw shot away and his vocal cords exposed, one with his femur smashed to bits by a bullet and his hands and face so badly burned that his face was just an eyelashless, eyebrowless, hairless blister, that they were Russians. No one could tell from the bodies of these wounded men he would leave in beds at the palace that they were Russians. Nothing proved a naked dead man was a Russian. Your nationality and your politics did not show when you were dead. Robert Jordan had asked Karkov how he felt about the necessity of performing this act, and Karkov had said that he had not looked forward to it. "How are you going to do it?" Robert Jordan had asked him, and had added, "You know it isn't so simple just suddenly to poison people." And Karkov had said, "Oh yes, it is when you carry it always for your own use." Then he had opened his cigarette case and showed Robert Jordan what he carried in one side of it. "But the first thing anybody would do if they took you prisoner would be to take your cigarette case," Robert Jordan had objected. "They would have your hands up." "But I have a little more here," Karkov had grinned and showed the lapel of his jacket. "You simply put the lapel in your mouth like this and bite it and swallow." "That's much better," Robert Jordan had said. "Tell me, does it smell like bitter almonds the way it always does in detective stories?" "I don't know," Karkov said delightedly. "I have never smelled it. Should we break a little tube and smell it?"
"Better keep it."
"Yes," Karkov said, and put the cigarette case away. "I am not a defeatist, you understand? But it is always possible that such serious times might come again, and you cannot get this anywhere. Have you seen the communique from the Cordoba front?
It is very beautiful.
It is now my favorite among all the communiques."
"What did it say?" Robert Jordan had come to Madrid from the Cordoban front, and he had the sudden stiffening that comes when someone jokes about a thing which you yourself may joke about, but which they may not. "Tell me."
"Nuestra gloriosa tropa siga avanzando sin perder ni un sola palma de terreno,"
Karkov said in his strange Spanish.
It didn't really say that, Robert Jordan doubted.
"Our glorious troops continue to advance without losing a foot of ground,"
Karkov repeated in English.
"It is in the communique. I will find it for you."
You could remember the men you knew who died in the fighting around Pozo Blanco, but it was a joke at Gaylord's. So that was the way it was at Gaylord's now. Still, there had not always been Gaylord's, and if the situation was now one which produced such a thing as Gaylord's out of the survivors of the early days, he was glad to see Gaylord's and to know about it. "You are a long way from how you felt in the Sierra, and at Carabanchel, and at Usera," he thought. "You corrupt very easily," he thought. "But was it corruption, or was it merely that you lost the naivete that you started with? Would it not be the same in anything? Who else kept that first chastity of mind about their work that young doctors, young priests, and young soldiers usually started with? The priests certainly kept it, or they got out. I suppose the Nazis keep it," he thought, "and the communists, who have a severe enough self-discipline. But look at Karkov." He never tired of considering the case of Karkov. The last time he had been at Gaylord's, Kharkov had been wonderful about a certain British economist who had spent much time in Spain. Robert Jordan had read this man's writing for years, and he had always respected him without knowing anything about him. He had not cared very much for what this man had written about Spain. It was too clear and simple, and too open and shut, and many of the statistics he knew were faked by wishful thinking. But he thought, you rarely cared for journalism written about a country you really knew about, and he respected the man for his intentions. Then he had seen the man, finally, on the afternoon when they had attacked at Carabanchel. They were sitting in the lee of the bullring, and there was shooting down the two streets, and everyone was nervous, waiting for the attack. A tank had been promised, and it had not come up, and Montero was sitting with his head in his hand, saying, "The tank has not come. The tank has not come." It was a cold day, and the yellow dust was blowing down the street, and Montero had been hit in the left arm, and the arm was stiffening. "We have to have a tank," he said. "We must wait for the tank, but we cannot wait." His wound was making him sound petulant. Robert Jordan had gone back to look for the tank, which Montero said he thought might have stopped behind the apartment building on the corner of the tram line. It was there all right, but it was not a tank. Spaniards called anything a tank in those days. It was an old armored car. The driver did not want to leave the angle of the apartment house and bring it up to the bullring. He was standing behind it with his arms folded against the metal of the car and his head in the leather-padded helmet on his arms. He shook his head when Robert Jordan spoke to him and kept it pressed against his arms. Then he turned his head without looking at Robert Jordan.
"I have no orders to go there," he said sullenly.
Robert Jordan had taken his pistol out of the holster and pushed the muzzle of the pistol against the leather coat of the armored car driver. "Here are your orders," he had told him. The man shook his head, with the big padded leather helmet like a football player's on it, and said,
"There is no ammunition for the machine gun."
"We have ammunition at the bullring," Robert Jordan had told him. "Come on, let's go. We will fill the belts there. Come on."
"There is no one to work the gun," the driver said.
"Where is he? Where is your mate?"
"Dead," the driver had said. "Inside there."
"Get him out," Robert Jordan had said. "Get him out of there."
"I do not like to touch him," the driver had said. "And he is bent over between the gun and the wheel, and I cannot get past him."
"Come on," Robert Jordan had said. "We will get him out together." He had banged his head as he climbed into the armored car, and it had made a small cut over his eyebrow that bled down onto his face. The dead man was heavy, and so stiff you could not bend him, and he had to hammer at his head to get it out from where it had wedged, face down between his seat and the wheel. Finally he got it up by pushing with his knee up under the dead man's head, and then, pulling back on the man's waist now that the head was loose, he pulled the dead man out himself toward the door.
"Give me a hand with him," he had said to the driver.
"I do not want to touch him," the driver had said, and Robert Jordan had seen that he was crying. The tears ran straight down on each side of his nose and the powder-grimed slope of his face, and his nose was running too.
Standing beside the door, he had swung the dead man out, and the dead man fell onto the sidewalk beside the tram line, still in that hunched-over, doubled-up position. He lay there, his face waxy gray against the cement sidewalk, his hands bent under him, as they had been in the car.
"Get in, goddammit,"
Robert Jordan had said, motioning now with his pistol to the driver.
"Get in there now."
Just then he had seen this man who had come out from the lee of the apartment house building. He had on a long overcoat, and he was bareheaded, and his hair was gray, his cheekbones broad, and his eyes were deep and set close together. He had a package of Chesterfields in his hand, and he took one out and handed it toward Robert Jordan, who was pushing the driver into the armored car with his pistol.
"Just a minute, comrade," he had said to Robert Jordan in Spanish. "Can you explain to me something about the fighting?"
Robert Jordan took the cigarette and put it in the breast pocket of his blue mechanic jumper. He had recognized this comrade from his pictures. It was the British economist. "Go muck yourself," he said in English, and then in Spanish to the armored car driver. "Down there, the bullring, see?" And he had pulled the heavy side door to with a slam and locked it, and they had started down that long slope in the car, and the bullets had commenced to hit against the car, sounding like pebbles tossed against an iron boiler. Then when the machine gun opened on them, they were like sharp hammer tappings.
They had pulled up behind the shelter of the bullring, with the last October posters still pasted up beside the ticket window, and the ammunition boxes knocked open, and the comrades with the rifles, the grenades on their belts and in their pockets, waiting there, in the lee, and Montero had said, "Good. Here's the tank. Now we can attack." Later that night, when they had the last houses on the hill, he lay comfortable behind a brick wall with a hole knocked in the bricks for a loophole, and looked across the beautiful level field of fire they had between them and the ridge the fascists had retired to, and thought, with a comfort that was almost voluptuous, of the rise of the hill with the smashed villa that protected the left flank. He had lain in a pile of straw in his sweat-soaked clothes, and wound a blanket around him while he dried. Lying there, he thought of the economist, and laughed, and then felt sorry he had been rude. But at the moment, when the man had handed him the cigarette, pushing it out almost like offering a tip for information, the combatant's hatred for the non-combatant had been too much for him. Now he remembered Gaylord's and Kharkov speaking of this same man.
"So it was there you met him," Kharkov had said. "I did not get farther than the Puente de Toledo myself on that day. He was very far toward the front. That was the last day of his bravery, I believe. He left Madrid the next day. Toledo was where he was the bravest, I believe. At Toledo he was enormous. He was one of the architects of our capture of the Alcazar. You should have seen him at Toledo. I believe it was largely through his efforts and his advice that our siege was successful. That was the silliest part of the war. It reached an ultimate in silliness, but tell me, what is thought of him in America?"
"In America," Robert Jordan said, "he is supposed to be very close to Moscow."
"Eh, he's not," said Kharkov. "But he has a wonderful face and his manners are very successful. Now, with my face, I could do nothing. What little I have accomplished was all done in spite of my face, which does not either inspire people nor move them to love me and to trust me. But this man Mitchell has a face he makes his fortune with. It is the face of a conspirator. All who have read of conspirators in books trust him instantly. Also, he is the true manner of the conspirator. Anyone seeing him enter a room knows that he is instantly in the presence of a conspirator of the first mark. All of your rich compatriots who wish sentimentally to aid the Soviet Union, as they believe or to ensure themselves a little against any eventual success of the party, see instantly in the face of this man, and in his manner, that he can be none other than a trusted agent of the Comintern."
"Has he no connections in Moscow?"
"None. Listen, Comrade Jordan. Do you know about the two kinds of fools? Plain and damn?"
"No.
The two kinds of fools we have in Russia," Kharkov grinned and began. "First, there is the winter fool. The winter fool comes to the door of your house, and he knocks loudly. You go to the door and you see him there, and you have never seen him before. He is an impressive sight. He's a very big man. He has on high boots and a fur coat and a fur hat, and he is all covered with snow. First he stamps his boots, and snow falls from them. Then he takes off his fur coat and shakes it, and more snow falls. Then he takes off his fur hat and knocks it against the door. More snow falls from his fur hat. Then he stamps his boots again and advances into the room. Then you look at him, and you see he is a fool. That is the winter fool. Now in the summer, you see a fool going down the street, and he is waving his arms and jerking his head from side to side, and everybody from 200 yards away can tell, he is a fool. That is a summer fool. This economist is a winter fool."
"But why do people trust him here?" Robert Jordan asked.
"His face," Kharkov said. "His beautiful gueule de conspirateur. And his invaluable trick of just having come from somewhere else where he is very trusted and important. Of course," he smiled, "he must travel very much to keep the trick working."
"You know, the Spanish are very strange," Kharkov went on. "This government has had much money, much gold. They will give nothing to their friends.
You are a friend? All right, you will do it for nothing and should not be rewarded. But to people representing an important firm or a country which is not friendly, but must be influenced, to such people they give much. It is very interesting when you follow it closely."
"I do not like it. Also, that money belongs to the Spanish workers.
You are not supposed to like things, only to understand, Karkov had told him.
I teach you a little each time I see you, and eventually you will acquire an education.
It would be very interesting for a professor to be educated.
I don't know whether I'll be able to be a professor when I get back. They will probably run me out as a Red.
Well, perhaps you will be able to come to the Soviet Union and continue your studies there.
That might be the best thing for you to do. But Spanish is my field.
There are many countries where Spanish is spoken, Karkov had said. They cannot all be as difficult to do anything with as Spain is.
Then you must remember that you have not been a professor now for almost 9 months. In 9 months you may have learned a new trade. How much dialectics have you read?
I have read the Handbook of Marxism that Emil Burns edited, that is all.
If you have read it all, that is quite a little.
There are 1,500 pages and you could spend some time on each page. But there are some other things you should read.
There is no time to read now.
I know, Karkov had said. I mean eventually. There are many things to read which will make you understand some of these things that happen. But out of this will come a book which is very necessary, which will explain many things which it is necessary to know.
Perhaps I will write it. I hope that it will be me who will write it.
I don't know who could write it better.
Do not flatter, Karkov had said. I am a journalist, but like all journalists, I wish to write literature. Just now I am very busy on a study of Calvo Sotelo. He is a very good fascist, a true Spanish fascist. Franco and these other people are not. I have been studying all of Sotelo's writings and speeches. He was very intelligent, and it was very intelligent that he was killed.
I thought you did not believe in political assassination.
It is practiced very extensively, Karkov said. Very, very extensively.
But
we do not believe in acts of terrorism by individuals, Karkov had smiled. Not, of course, by criminal terrorists and counter-revolutionary organizations. We detest with horror the duplicity and villainy of the murderous hyenas of Bukharanite wreckers and such dregs of humanity as Zinoviev, Kamenev, Rykov, and their henchmen. We hate and loathe these veritable fiends, he smiled again. But I still believe that political assassination can be said to be practiced very extensively.
You mean?
I mean nothing. But certainly we execute and destroy such veritable fiends and dregs of humanity, and the treacherous dogs of generals and the revolting spectacle of admirals unfaithful to their trust. These are destroyed. They are not assassinated. You see the difference?
I see, Robert Jordan had said.
And because I make jokes sometime, and you know how dangerous it is to make jokes even in joke.
Good, because I make jokes, do not think that the Spanish people will not live to regret that they have not shot certain generals that even now hold commands.
I do not like the shootings, you understand?
I don't mind them, Robert Jordan said. I do not like them, but I do not mind them any more.
I know that, Karkov had said. I have been told that.
Is it important? Robert Jordan said. I was only trying to be truthful about it.
It is regretful, Karkov had said, but it is one of the things that makes people be treated as reliable who would ordinarily have to spend much more time before attaining that category.
Am I supposed to be reliable?
In your work, you are supposed to be very reliable. I must talk to you sometime to see how you are in your mind. It is regrettable that we never speak seriously.
My mind is in suspension until we win the war, Robert Jordan had said.
Then perhaps you will not need it for a long time. But you should be careful to exercise it a little.
I read Mundo Obrero, Robert Jordan had told him, and Karkov had said,
All right, good. I can take a joke, too, but there are very intelligent things in Mundo Obrero. The only intelligent things written on this war.
Yes, Robert Jordan had said. I agree with you. But to get a full picture of what is happening, you cannot read only the party organ.
No, Karkov had said. But you will not find any such picture if you read 20 papers. And then if you had it, I do not know what you would do with it.
I have such a picture almost constantly. And what I do is try to forget it.
You think it is that bad?
It is better now than it was. We are getting rid of some of the worst, but it is very rotten. We are building a huge army now, and some of the elements, those of Modesto, of El Campesino, of Lister, and of Duran, are reliable. They are more than reliable. They are magnificent. You will see that. Also, we still have the brigades, although their role is changing. But an army that is made up of good and bad elements cannot win a war. All must be brought to a certain level of political development. All must know why they are fighting, and its importance. All must believe in the fight they are to make, and all must accept discipline. We are making a huge conscript army without the time to implant the discipline that a conscript army must have to behave properly under fire. We call it a people's army, but it will not have the assets of a true people's army, and it will not have the iron discipline that a conscript army needs. You will see. It is a very dangerous procedure. You are not very cheerful today.
No, Kharkov had said.
I have just come back from Valencia, where I have seen many people. No one comes back very cheerful from Valencia. In Madrid you feel good and clean and with no possibility of anything but winning. Valencia is something else. The cowards who fled from Madrid still govern there. They have settled happily into the sloth and bureaucracy of governing. They have only contempt for those of Madrid. Their obsession now is the weakening of the commissariat for war. And Barcelona, you should see Barcelona.
How is it?
It is all still comic opera. First it was the paradise of the crackpots and the romantic revolutionists. Now it is the paradise of the fake soldier. The soldiers who like to wear uniforms, who like to strut and swagger and to wear red and black scarves, who like everything about war except to fight. Valencia makes you sick, and Barcelona makes you laugh.
What about the POUM putsch?
The POUM was never serious. It was a heresy of crackpots and wild men, and it was really just an infantilism. There were some honest, misguided people. There was one fairly good brain, and there was a little fascist money, not much. The poor POUM. They were very silly people.
But were many killed in the putsch?
Not so many as were shot afterwards, or will be shot. The POUM. It is like the name, not serious. They should have called it the MUMPS, or the MEASLES. But no. The measles is much more dangerous. It can affect both sight and hearing. But they made one plot, you know, to kill me, to kill Walter, to kill Modesto, and to kill Prieto. You see how badly mixed up they were? We are not all alike. Poor POUM. They never did kill anybody. Not at the front nor anywhere else. A few in Barcelona, yes.
Were you there?
Yes. I have sent a cable describing the wickedness of that infamous organization of Trotskyite murderers and their fascist machinations all beneath contempt, but between us, it is not very serious, the POUM. Nin was their only man. We had him, but he escaped from our hands.
Where is he now?
In Paris. We say he is in Paris. He was a very pleasant fellow, but with bad political aberrations.
But they were in communication with the fascists, weren't they?
Who is not?
We are not.
Who knows? I hope we are not. You go often behind their lines, he grinned. But the brother of one of the secretaries of the Republican embassy at Paris made a trip to Saint-Jean-de-Luz last week to meet people from Burgos.
I like it better at the front, Robert Jordan had said. The closer to the front, the better the people.
How do you like it behind the fascist lines?
Very much. We have fine people there.
Well, you see, they must have their fine people behind our lines the same way. We find them and shoot them, and they find ours and shoot them.
When you are in their country,
you must always think of how many people they must send over to us.
I have thought about them.
Well, Kharkov had said, you have probably enough to think about for today. So drink that beer that is left in the pitcher and run along now, because I have to go upstairs to see people. Upstairs, people. Come again to see me soon.
Yes, Robert Jordan thought. You learned a lot at Gaylord's. Kharkov had read the one and only book he had published. The book had not been a success. It was only 200 pages long, and he doubted if 2,000 people had ever read it. He had put in it what he had discovered about Spain and 10 years of traveling in it, on foot. in third-class carriages, by bus, on horse and mule back, and in trucks. He knew the Basque country, Navarre, Aragon, Galicia, the two Castiles, and Estremadura well. There had been such good books written by Barrow and Ford and the rest that he had been able to add very little. But Kharkov said it was a good book.
"It is why I bother with you," he said. "I think you write absolutely truly, and that is very rare. So I would like you to know some things."
All right. He would write a book when he got through with this, but only about the things he knew truly, and about what he knew. But I will have to be a much better writer than I am now to handle them, he thought. The things he had come to know in this war were not so simple. Chapter 19.
"What do you do sitting there?" Maria asked him. She was standing close beside him, and he turned his head and smiled at her.
"Nothing," he said. "I have been thinking."
"What of? The bridge?"
"No, the bridge is terminated. Of thee, and of a hotel in Madrid where I know some Russians, and of a book I will write sometime."
"Are there many Russians in Madrid?"
"No, very few."
"But in the fascist periodicals, it says there are hundreds of thousands."
"Those are lies. There are very few."
"Do you like the Russians? The one who was here was a Russian."
"Did you like him?"
"Yes. I was sick then, but I thought he was very beautiful and very brave."
"What nonsense, beautiful," Pilar said. "His nose was flat as my hand, and he had cheekbones as wide as a sheep's buttocks." "He was a good friend and comrade of mine," Robert Jordan said to Maria. "I cared for him very much."
"Sure,"
Pilar said. "But you shot him." When she said this, the card players looked up from the table, and Pablo stared at Robert Jordan. Nobody said anything, and then the gypsy, Raphael, asked,
"Is it true, Roberto?"
"Yes," Robert Jordan said. He wished Pilar had not brought this up, and he wished he had not told it at El Sordo's. At his request, he was badly wounded.
"Qué cosa más rara," the gypsy said. "All the time he was with us he talked of such a possibility. I don't know how many times I have promised him to perform such an act. What a rare thing," he said again, and shook his head.
"He was a very rare man," Primitivo said. "Very singular." "Look, Andres," one of the brothers said, "you who are professor and all, do you believe in the possibility of a man seeing ahead what is to happen to him?" "I believe he cannot see it," Robert Jordan said. Pablo was staring at him curiously, and Pilar was watching him with no expression on her face. In the case of this Russian comrade, he was very nervous from being too much time at the front. He had fought at Irun, which you know was bad, very bad. He had fought later in the north, and since the first groups who did this work behind the lines were formed, he had worked here, in Estremadura and in Andalusia. I think he was very tired and nervous, and he imagined ugly things.
"He would undoubtedly have seen many evil things," Fernando said.
"Like all the world," Andres said. "But listen to me, Inglés. Do you think there is such a thing as a man knowing in advance what will befall him?" "No," Robert Jordan said. "That is ignorance and superstition."
"Go on," Pilar said. "Let us hear the viewpoint of the professor."
She spoke as though she were talking to a precocious child. "I believe that fear produces evil visions," Robert Jordan said. "Seeing bad signs,
such as the airplanes today," Primitivo said.
"Such as thy arrival," Pablo said softly, and Robert Jordan looked across the table at him, saw it was not a provocation but only an expressed thought, then went on. "Seeing bad signs, one with fear imagines an end for himself, and one thinks that imagining comes by divination," Robert Jordan concluded. "I believe there is nothing more to it than that. I do not believe in ogres nor soothsayers, nor in the supernatural things."
"But this one with the rare name saw his fate clearly," the gypsy said, "and that was how it happened."
"He did not see it," Robert Jordan said. "He had a fear of such a possibility, and it became an obsession. No one can tell me that he saw anything."
"Not I?"
Pilar asked him, and picked some dust up from the fire and blew it off the palm of her hand.
"I cannot tell thee either?"
"No. With all wizardry, gypsy and all, thou canst not tell me either."
"Because thou art a miracle of deafness," Pilar said, her big face harsh and broad in the candlelight. "It is not that thou art stupid. Thou art simply deaf. One who is deaf cannot hear music, neither can he hear the radio. So he might say, never having heard them, that such things do not exist. Que va, Inglés? I saw the death of that one with the rare name in his face as though it were burned there with a branding iron.
You did not, Robert Jordan insisted. You saw fear and apprehension. The fear was made by what he had been through. The apprehension was for the possibility of evil he imagined.
Que va,
Pilar said. I saw death there as plainly as though it were sitting on his shoulder. And what is more, he smelt of death.
He smelt of death, Robert Jordan jeered. Of fear, maybe. There is a smell to fear.
De la muerte, Pilar said.
Listen, when Blanquet, who was the greatest peón de Brega who ever lived, worked under the orders of Granero, he told me that on the day of Manolo Granero's death, when they stopped in the chapel on the way to the ring, the odor of death was so strong on Manolo that it almost made Blanquet sick. And he had been with Manolo when he had bathed and dressed at the hotel before setting out for the ring. The odor was not present in the motor car when they had sat packed tight together riding to the bullring. Nor was it distinguishable to anyone else but Juan Luis de la Rosa in the chapel. Neither Marcial nor Chicuelo smelled it neither then, nor when the four of them lined up for the paseo. But Juan Luis was dead white, Blanquet told me, and he, Blanquet, spoke to him, saying, Thou also? So that I cannot breathe, Juan Luis said to him, and from thy matador.
Pues nada, Blanquet said, there is nothing to do. Let us hope we are mistaken.
And the others? Juan Luis asked Blanquet.
Nada, Blanquet said, nothing. But this one stinks worse than José at Talavera.
And it was on that afternoon that the bull Pocapena, of the ranch of Veragua, destroyed Manolo Granero against the planks of the barrier in front of Tendido 2 in the Plaza de Toros of Madrid. I was there with Finito and I saw it. The horn entirely destroyed the cranium, the head of Manolo being wedged under the estribo at the base of the barrera where the bull had tossed him.
But did you smell anything? Fernando asked.
Nay, Pilar said. I was too far away. We were in the 7th row of the Tendido 3. It was thus, being at an angle, that I could see all that happened. But that same night, Blanquet, who had been under the orders of Joselito when he too was killed, told Finito about it at Fornos, and Finito asked Juan Luis de la Rosa, and he would say nothing. But he nodded his head that it was true. I was present when this happened. So, Inglés, it may be that thou art deaf to some things, as Chicuelo and Marcial Lalanda, and all of their bandarilleros and picadores, and all of the gente of Juan Luis and Manolo Granero were deaf to this thing on this day. But Juan Luis and Blanquet were not deaf. Nor am I deaf to such things.
Why do you say deaf when it is a thing of the nose? Fernando asked.
Leche, Pilar said. Thou shouldst be the professor in place of the Inglés.
But I could tell thee of other things, Inglés, and do not doubt what thou simply cannot see, nor cannot hear. Thou canst not hear what a dog hears, nor canst thou smell what a dog smells. But already thou hast experienced a little of what can happen to man.
Maria put her hand on Robert Jordan's shoulder, and let it rest there, and he thought suddenly, Let us finish all this nonsense, and take advantage of what time we have. But it is too early yet. We have to kill this part of the evening. So he said to Pablo, Thou, believest thou in this wizardry?
I do not know, Pablo said. I am more of thy opinion. No supernatural thing has ever happened to me. But fear? Yes, certainly. Plenty. But I believe that the Pilar can divine events from the hand. If she does not lie, perhaps it is true that she has smelt such a thing.
Que va that I should lie, Pilar said. This is not a thing of my invention. This man Blanquet was a man of extreme seriousness, and furthermore very devout. He was no gypsy, but a bourgeois from Valencia. Hast thou never seen him?
Yes, Robert Jordan said. I have seen him many times. He was small, grey-faced, and no one handled a cape better. He was quick on his feet as a rabbit.
Exactly, Pilar said. He had a grey face from heart trouble. And Gypsy said that he carried death with him, but that he could flick it away with a cape as you might dust a table. Yet he, who was no gypsy, smelled death on Joselito when he fought at Talavera. Although I do not see how he could smell it above the smell of Manzanilla. Blanquet spoke of this afterwards with much diffidence, but those to whom he spoke said that it was a fantasy, and that what he had smelled was the life that Jose led at that time, coming out in sweat from his armpits. But then later came this of Manolo Granero, in which Juan Luis de la Rosa also participated. Clearly Juan Luis was a man of very little honor, but of much sensitiveness in his work, and he was also a great layer of women. But Blanquette was serious, and very quiet, and completely incapable of telling an untruth. And I tell you that I smell death on your colleague who was here.
I do not believe it, Robert Jordan said. Also, you said that Blanquette smelled this just before the paseo, just before the bullfight started. Now, this was a successful action here of you and Kashkin and the train. He was not killed in that. How could you smell it, then?
That has nothing to do with it, Pilar explained. In the last season of Ignacio Sanchez Mejias, he smelled so strongly of death that many refused to sit with him in the café. All gypsies knew of this.
After the death, such things are invented, Robert Jordan argued. Everyone knew that Sanchez Mejias was on the road to a coronada, because he had been too long out of training, because his style was heavy and dangerous, and because his strength and the agility in his legs were gone, and his reflexes no longer as they had been.
Certainly, Pilar told him, all of that is true. But all the gypsies knew also that he smelled of death, and when he would come into the Via Rosa, you would see such people as Ricardo and Felipe Gonzalez leaving by the small door behind the bar.
They probably owed him money, Robert Jordan said.
It is possible, Pilar said, very possible. But they also smelled the thing, and all knew of it.
What she says is true, Inglés, the gypsy Raphael said. It is a well-known thing among us.
I believe none of it, Robert Jordan said.
Listen, Inglés, Anselmo began. I am against all such wizardry. But this Pilar has the fame of being very advanced in such things.
But what does it smell like? Fernando asked. What odor has it? If there be an odor, it must be a definite odor.
You want to know, Fernandito? Pilar smiled at him. You think that you could smell it?
If it actually exists, why should I not smell it as well as another?
Why not?
Pilar was making fun of him, her big hands folded across her knees.
Hast thou ever been aboard a ship, Fernando?
Nay, and I would not wish to.
Then thou might not recognize it, for part of it is the smell that comes when on a ship there is a storm, and the portholes are closed up. Put your nose against the brass handle of a screwed-tight porthole on a rolling ship that is swaying under you, so that you are faint and hollow in the stomach, and you have a part of that smell.
It would be impossible for me to recognize, because I will go on no ship, Fernando said.
I have been on ships several times, Pilar said, both to go to Mexico and to Venezuela.
What's the rest of it? Robert Jordan asked.
Pilar looked at him mockingly, remembering now, proudly, her voyages.
All right, Inglés, learn. That's the thing, learn.
All right.
After that of the ship, you must go down the hill in Madrid to the Puente de Toledo, early in the morning to the Matadero, and stand there on the wet paving when there is a fog from the Manzanares, and wait for the old women who go before daylight to drink the blood of the beasts that are slaughtered. When such an old woman comes out of the Matadero, holding her shawl around her, with her face gray and her eyes hollow, and the whiskers of age on her chin and on her cheeks, set in the waxen white of her face as the sprouts grow from the seed of the bean, not bristles, but pale sprouts in the death of her face. Put your arms tight around her, Inglés, and hold her to you, and kiss her on the mouth, and you will know the second part that odor is made of.
That one has taken my appetite, the gypsy said. That of the sprouts was too much.
Do you want to hear some more? Pilar asked Robert Jordan.
Surely, he said. If it is necessary for one to learn, let us learn.
That of the sprouts in the face of the old women sickens me,
the gypsy said.
Why should that occur in old women, Pilar? With us it is not so.
Nay, Pilar mocked at him. With us the old woman, who was so slender in her youth, except, of course, for the perpetual bulge that is the mark of her husband's favor, that every gypsy pushes always before her.
Do not speak thus, Raphael said. It is ignoble.
So thou art hurt, Pilar said. Hast thou ever seen a gitana who was not about to have, or just to have had, a child?
Thou?
Leave it, Pilar said. There is no one who cannot be hurt. What I was saying is that age brings its own form of ugliness to all. There is no need to detail it. But if the Inglés must learn that odor that he covets to recognize, he must go to the Matadero early in the morning.
I will go, Robert Jordan said.
but I will get the odor as they pass without kissing one. I fear the sprouts, too, as Raphael does.
Kiss one, Pilar said. Kiss one, Inglés, for thy knowledge's sake. And then, with this in thy nostrils, walk back up into the city, and when thou seest a refuse pail with dead flowers in it, plunge thy nose deep into it, and inhale so that the scent mixes with those thou hast already in thy nasal passages.
Now have I done it, Robert Jordan said. What flowers were they?
Chrysanthemums.
Continue, Robert Jordan said. I smell them.
Then, Pilar went on, it is important that the day be in autumn with rain, or at least some fog, or early winter even. And now thou shouldst continue to walk through the city and down the Calle de Salud, smelling what thou wilt smell where they are sweeping out the casas de putas and emptying the slop jars into the drains, and with this odor of love's labor lost, mixed sweetly with soapy water and cigarette butts, only faintly reaching thy nostrils, thou shouldst go on to the Jardín Botánico, where at night those girls who can no longer work in the houses do their work against the iron gates of the park and the iron picketed fences and upon the sidewalks. It is there in the shadow of the trees against the iron railings that they will perform all that a man wishes, from the simplest requests at a remuneration of 10 centimos up to a peseta for that great act that we are born to, and there, on a dead flower bed that has not yet been plucked out and replanted, and so serves to soften the earth that is so much softer than the sidewalk, thou wilt find an abandoned gunny sack with the odor of the wet earth, the dead flowers, and the doings of that night. In this sack will be contained the essence of it all, both the dead earth and the dead stalks of the flowers and their rotted blooms and the smell that is both the death and birth of man. Thou wilt wrap this sack around thy head and try to breathe through it.
No.
Yes, Pilar said, thou wilt wrap this sack around thy head and try to breathe. And then, if thou hast not lost any of the previous odors, when thou inhalest deeply, thou wilt smell the odor of death to come as we know it.
All right, Robert Jordan said. And you say Kashkin smelt like that when he was here?
Yes.
Well, said Robert Jordan gravely, if that is true, it is a good thing that I shot him.
Olé,
the gypsy said. The others laughed.
Very good, Primitivo approved. That should hold her for a while.
But Pilar, Fernando said, surely you could not expect one of Don Roberto's education to do such vile things.
No, Pilar agreed.
All of that is of the utmost repugnance.
Yes, Pilar agreed.
You would not expect him actually to perform those degrading acts.
No, Pilar said. Go to bed, will you?
But Pilar, Fernando went on.
Shut up, will you? Pilar said to him suddenly and viciously. Do not make a fool of thyself, and I will try not to make a fool of myself talking with people who cannot understand what one speaks of.
I confess I do not understand, Fernando began.
Don't confess, and don't try to understand, Pilar said. Is it still snowing outside?
Robert Jordan went to the mouth of the cave, lifted the blanket, and looked out. It was clear and cold in the night outside, and no snow was falling. He looked through the tree trunks where the whiteness lay and up through the trees to where the sky was now clear. The air came into his lungs sharp and cold as he breathed. El Sordo will leave plenty of tracks if he has stolen horses tonight, he thought. He dropped the blanket and came back into the smoky cave. It is clear, he said. The storm is over. Chapter 20 Now in the night he lay, and waited for the girl to come to him. There was no wind now, and the pines were still in the night. The trunks of the pines projected from the snow that covered all the ground, and he lay in the robe, feeling the suppleness of the bed under him that he had made, his legs stretched long against the warmth of the robe, the air sharp and cold on his head and in his nostrils as he breathed. Under his head, as he lay on his side, was the bulge of the trousers and the coat that he had wrapped around his shoes to make a pillow. And against his side was the cold metal of the big, automatic pistol he had taken from the holster when he undressed and fastened by its lanyard to his right wrist. He pushed the pistol away and settled deeper into the robe as he watched, across the snow, the dark break in the rocks that was the entrance to the cave. The sky was clear, and there was enough light reflected from the snow to see the trunks of the trees and the bulk of the rocks where the cave was. Earlier in the evening he had taken the axe and gone outside of the cave, and walked through the new snow to the edge of the clearing, and cut down a small spruce tree. In the dark he had dragged it, butt first, to the lee of the rock wall. There, close to the rock, he had held the tree upright, holding the trunk firm with one hand, and holding the axe haft close to the head, had lopped off all the boughs until he had a pile of them. Then, leaving the pile of boughs, he had laid the bare pole of the trunk down in the snow and gone into the cave to get a slab of wood he had seen against the wall. With this slab he scraped the ground clear of the snow along the rock wall, and then picked up his boughs and, shaking them clean of snow, laid them in rows, like overlapping plumes, until he had a bed. He put the pole across the foot of the bough bed to hold the branches in place, and pegged it firm with two pointed pieces of wood he split from the edge of the slab. Then he carried the slab and the axe back into the cave, ducking under the blanket as he came in, and leaned them both against the wall. "What do you do outside?" Pilar had asked. "I made a bed." "Don't cut pieces from my new shelf for thy bed." "I am sorry." "It has no importance," she said. "There are more slabs at the sawmill. What sort of bed hast thou made?" "As in my country." "Then sleep well on it," she had said. And Robert Jordan had opened one of the packs and pulled the robe out and replaced those things wrapped in it back in the pack and carried the robe out, ducking under the blanket again, and spread it over the boughs so that the closed end of the robe was against the pole that was pegged crosswise at the foot of the bed. The open head of the robe was protected by the rock wall of the cliff. Then he went back into the cave for his packs, but Pilar said, "They can sleep with me as last night." "Will you not have sentries?" he asked. "The night is clear and the storm is over." "Fernando goes," Pilar said. Maria was in the back of the cave, and Robert Jordan could not see her. "Good night to everyone," he had said. "I am going to sleep." Of the others who were laying out blankets and bedrolls on the floor in front of the cooking fire, pushing back the slab tables and the rawhide-covered stools to make sleeping space, Primitivo and Andres looked up and said, "Buenas noches." Anselmo was already asleep in a corner, rolled in his blanket and his cape, not even his nose showing. Pablo was asleep in his chair. "Do you want a sheep hide for thy bed?" Pilar asked Robert Jordan softly. "Nay," he said, "thank thee. I do not need it." "Sleep well," she said. "I will respond for thy material." Fernando had gone out with him and stood a moment where Robert Jordan had spread the sleeping robe.
"You have a curious idea to sleep in the open, Don Roberto," he said, standing there in the dark, muffled in his blanket cape, his carbine slung over his shoulder.
"I am accustomed to it. Good night."
"Since you are accustomed to it."
"When are you relieved?"
"At 4.
"There is much cold between now and then."
"I am accustomed to it," Fernando said.
"Since then you are accustomed to it," Robert Jordan said politely.
"Yes," Fernando agreed. "Now I must get up there. Good night, Don Roberto."
"Good night, Fernando."
Then he had made a pillow of the things he took off, and gotten into the robe, and then lain and waited, feeling the spring of the boughs under the flannelly, feathered lightness of the robe warmth, watching the mouth of the cave across the snow, feeling his heartbeat as he waited. The night was clear, and his head felt as clear and cold as the air. He smelled the odor of the pine boughs under him, the piney smell of the crushed needles and the sharper odor of the resinous sap from the cut limbs. "Pilar," he thought. "Pilar and the smell of death. This is the smell I love. This and fresh-cut clover, the crushed sage as you ride after cattle, wood smoke, and the burning leaves of autumn. That must be the odor of nostalgia, the smell of the smoke from the piles of raked leaves burning in the streets in the fall in Missoula. Which would you rather smell? Sweet grass the Indians used in their baskets, smoked leather, the odor of the ground in the spring after rain, the smell of the sea as you walk through the gorse on a headland in Galicia, or the wind from the land as you come in toward Cuba in the dark. That was the odor of the cactus flowers, mimosa, and the sea grape shrubs. Or would you rather smell frying bacon in the morning when you are hungry, or coffee in the morning, or a Jonathan apple as you bit into it, or a cider mill in the grinding, or bread fresh from the oven? You must be hungry, he thought, and he lay on his side and watched the entrance of the cave and the light that the stars reflected from the snow. Someone came out from under the blanket and he could see whoever it was standing by the break in the rock that made the entrance. Then he heard a slithering sound in the snow, and then whoever it was ducked down and went back in. "I suppose she won't come until they are all asleep," he thought. "It is a waste of time. The night is half gone. Oh, Maria, come now quickly, Maria, for there is little time."